Councillor Jones with Lord Sladbrook, thank you for coming today. I would like to thank you for your interest in the inquiry and for your appearance at today's hearing. The purpose of this hearing is to assist Professor Taran Miramantu in gathering evidence for the Climate Health WA inquiry into the impacts of climate change on health in Western Australia. My name is Dr. Sarah Joyce, I'm the Project Director for the inquiry. To my right is Dr. Rebel Bangor-Jones, the Public Health Advisor for the inquiry. I have been instructed by Professor Riramantu under Section 230 of the Public Health Act 2016 to conduct today's hearing. Please be aware that the use of mobile phones and other recording devices are not permitted in this room, and if you would please make sure that phones are silent or switched off. This hearing is a formal procedure convened under Section 231 of the Public Health Act 2016. While you are not being asked to give your evidence under oath or affirmation, it is important you understand that there are penalties under the Act for knowingly providing a response to information that is false or misleading. This is a public hearing and a transcript of your evidence will be made for the public record. If you wish to make a confidential statement during today's proceedings, you should request that that part of your evidence be taken in private. You have previously been provided with the inquiry's terms of reference and information on giving evidence to the inquiry. Before we begin, do you have any questions about today's hearing?
No, I don't have any questions.
No questions. Thank you. For the transcript, could I ask each of you to state your name and the capacity in which you are here today? And could I also ask that throughout the hearing you briefly state your name prior to speaking for the audio transcript?
Okay. My name's Mark Jones. I'm a local government councillor with the City of Rockingham and also the chair of the Perrin Naturalist Partnership.
My name's Joanne Ludbrook. I'm the Coastal Adaptation Coordinator with the Perrin Naturalist Partnership.
Thank you. Would you like to make a brief opening statement?
Only a brief one, just to say thank you to that we can interview witnesses here today. So thank you for the opportunity and we wish the findings all the best as well.
Thank you. In return, I would like to thank you both for the submission to the inquiry. It's greatly appreciated, and particularly because it had a very strong focus on management of coastal hazards. Which leads into my first question, which is around what do you see as the current environmental threats, hazards or risks to the coastal region of Western Australia?
So, Mark Jones, I'll answer the first question. So I guess this is a lot of current evidence. The latest United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, that's IPCC, reports and state environment reports, they clearly state the climate change threats are increasing and are affecting things like air temperature, rainfall, humidity, sea levels, ocean temperatures and intensities and frequencies of storm events. So these changes are going to get worse over time, and existing coastal hazards and risks in the coastal zone over this time has the potential of serious detrimental impacts on our communities. So the Perrin Naturalist Partnership, the region which we present, has low-lying, sandy coastal and shallow estuarine environments and has high residential, commercial, recreational and social values. And our partnership, the work that we've done as a partnership and also the state and federal government, including the 2009 federal government first pass national assessment, the 2012 developing flexible adaptation pathways for the Perrin Naturalist region of Western Australia, it's called the CAPS report, and the recent 2018 and the WA hotspots report, they all suggest that coastal hazards will increase, causing risk to our coastal communities in the future. So some of the highlights of those reports, so there actually may be coastal erosion up to 200 to 300 metres off the coastal strip by 2100, so the 100-year time frame. Increasing storm activity, so that will include coastal flooding and marine inundation. I guess that's what I wanted to just highlight. So the City of Rockingham recently produced this coastal hazard and risk management adaptation plan, like charm mapping, and that just demonstrates, I can give you a copy of this plan, but the amount of inundation that could happen at 2110 with a five-year storm event sort of thing. So I guess there would be a lot of water, a lot of flooding. The water would sit around for, you know, a couple of days and things, and that would, you know, cause a lot of social, environmental and health issues as well. Yeah, so that's the impact of that. Also mosquito vector-borne diseases as well, a lot of that water sitting around, and also soil and water diseases, personal injury and loss of life. Yes, so there's also potential threats to critical health services and infrastructure, so currently located or proposed to be located in those coastal hazard zones. So you know, things like hospitals and emergency services facilities. Also the loss of beaches and foreshore impacts, and that affects biodiversity, but also the amenity and recreation, just the, how people have moved to the coast to enjoy the sandy beaches and they may not be there, over those times with the erosion. Also temporary flooding from that marine inundation, I think we talked about that, but also to vulnerable populations. So a lot of those people that might live in these low-lying areas, that they've got less resources and access to facilities and means as well to help themselves out. So there's a big risk there as well. The coastal erosion, coastal flooding impacting critical infrastructure. So even water rescue centres and things like boat ramps and things, like if there was an emergency, some of those facilities would be impacted, and it may actually impact our response to getting assistance to people. So yeah, with the loss of industries which rely on our waterways and coasts, such as tourism as well, commercial and accommodation businesses, and also commercial fishing. So as you can see, there's a lot of impacts for the health and well-being of our communities if there was all these environmental threats and hazards over time.
Thank you. You sort of touched, upon it already in your response to the first question, but did you want to expand a little bit around the contribution that climate change is making to those impacts and those risks?
Yes, so Mark Jones, I'll respond to this second question as well. And so there's a lot of reports and technical information available, which we draw on as well. I'm not admitting to be an expert on climate change, but I am qualified in town planning and urban planning, but more my colleague, Joanna Lodbrook, provides that technical expertise later on. But I guess the climate trends, and a lot of that was set up, that we're moving from a stable climate to a warming climate by about 2 to 5 degrees in the next 100 years. And also the current sea level is currently rising by about 2 millimetres per year in Western Australia. So the sea level rise is projected to increase, and there's been current scientific projections suggest more rapidly increasing sea level rise in the future. It's likely to be up 1 metre sea level rise by 2100. So the West Australian Planning Commission, they've released a Statement of Planning Policy 2.6, State Coastal Planning, and in that, I guess that's where that 0.9 or 1 metre rise has been given, and local governments are now having to prepare plans to see the impacts and how they're going to adapt to those as well. So we're likely to see increased coastal vulnerability from these trends. Also, just increasing storminess, cyclone and flooding events, extreme high sea level events, which will occur at the same time, so there's massive risk of flooding and erosion to those coastal areas. Also rainfall, we'd likely see rainfall become more unpredictable and more extreme weather events. And we're likely to see increased impact from larger coastal storms. So there was also some of the references. So CoastAdapt. A lot of information comes from that. It's commissioned by the federal government, part of the Federal Government of Environment, and it's the National Climate Change Adaptation Research Facility, and so that's where a lot of those figures come from as well. So.
Thank you. Okay, so the Perrin Naturalist Partnership, as you mentioned earlier in your opening statement, is a collaboration of 9 local governments.
Yes.
Could you explain to us why and how this partnership develops, what it hopes to achieve, and how it's funded?
Yes, for sure. So Mark Jones, I'll answer this one again. So it was established in 2011 by a memorandum of understanding, and we later became incorporated in 2015. he mentions the nine local governments, and they're the ones from the city of Rockingham in the north down to the city of Busselton in the south, which is Cape Naturalist. And there's seven coastal councils, and there's two which are estuarines, so the Shire of Dardanup and Shire of Murray are estuarine as well. They all contribute financially to that per annum based on their amount of coastline and also population. So currently, the member councils, we contribute $164,000 per annum, and say the City of Rockingham, City of Mandurah each contribute approximately $35,000 per annum, compared to the City of Bunbury around $26,000, and then the smaller local authorities less than that. Also, the group's been successful in obtaining approximately $750,000 in state and federal grants over those last 8 years, and generally they're matching funds, so 50% of the grant and 50% of the group goes towards projects. One of our main aims is to be proactive in advocating the need for effective leadership, funding and guidance on coastal climate change, adaptation from state and federal government. So that's the advocacy as well. And just some other points that we focus on. So we recognise the risks associated with climate change along a shared coastal zone. So it's one big region. You know, the coast doesn't stop at the local government boundaries, so that's why it's good to form a collective. And I think that's, I believe, why the group was established, because just going to do a project or apply for a grant for one local authority, it doesn't stop at the boundaries. So I think that's a great benefit of the partnership. And also working collaboratively, they address the risks associated with coastal climate change factors, aiming to build resilience in our coastal communities. So touching on the funding model, we feel it's an equitable model to contribute and gain benefits and reducing the risks and seeking opportunities to our coastal community. And I guess we provide a lot of that research and the science as well to our member councils. And we do a lot of the project work as well. So there's been coastal hazard assessments done on a regional scale, done some coastal monitoring and database management, risk mapping and adaptation planning, and even worked with the University of Western Australia. So they've done some like photographic work as well, just to map the beaches and how they're changing over time. So, have you got any other questions about this thing?
I'm just curious about some of the outputs that you mentioned there at the end, particularly the hazard maps and the development of the adaptation planning options, I think. Are you able to provide a bit more further detail around those projects?
Please go to Joe who can. It's more of a regional. So from that mapping, then each local government has to do more detailed mapping.
Right.
So that's like the City of Rockingham have just completed. But if you want to add any more.
Sure.
Yeah. So Joanne Ludbrook answering the question for. So in 2011, the PNP...
It was more about the projects and things? Is that right?
Yeah, outputs that you mentioned that have come out of the partnership.
Yeah. Is that covered in that?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Sorry.
No, that's okay. Yes. I think we're just good at streamlining along from that end.
Sure.
Okay, so I think just to expand on what Mark suggested around the first initial project we did on developing flexible adaptation pathways, which was both funded by State Department of Transport and the federal government in 2011, we did an economic-based regional analysis of the adaptation options to actually treat the impacts of coastal climate change hazards. So we initially had done the erosion mapping and the inundation mapping, and then actually did worked on some dedicated adaptation pathways and looking at options for future decision-making processes, and actually put some costs around the risks of the hazards, and then put some of did a bit of a cost-benefit analysis of what assets were at risk. So through that project, we identified that up to 2100, that erosion will be a major factor and probably more pervasive than the issue of flooding, although some recent science has shown that flooding will also be quite a major impact on our coastal communities. We're looking at around 800 hectares of residential land that would be subject to an increase in flooding risk around that entire 200-kilometre stretch of coastline. And that 300-metre strip of land coming from the coast inland, being in the coastal hazard zone up to 2100. So the value at risk for the entire area, these are very broad brush figures, again, on the regional analysis, was around $1.2 billion of assets at risk within the hazard zone to that 2100 period. And we looked at a couple of adaptation response options over time, and costing right out to the 2100 mark, we're looking at around $101 billion of assets being savable, and they really represent the larger communities where a lot of the people are focused. So it isn't a large percentage of the coastline itself, but it's where a lot of the assets are situated, meaning our large communities like Rockingham, Mandurah, Bunbury and Busselton, and they could be saved looking at a couple of the engineering options for responding to those risks at around $120 million. So the majority of our member councils are currently undertaking the Coastal Hazard Risk Management and Adaptation Plans, or CHRMAPs, or CHRMAPs as people call them, under the State Planning Policy, which Mark has alluded to, the first of which was the Shire of Harvey CHRMAP, which was supported by the Terra Naturalist Partnership and funded through the state government to undertake that work. More recently, the City of Rockingham, as Mark suggested, has been completed under this State Planning Policy 2.6 requirement of individual councils undertaking further studies, and this has provided a huge amount of insight into these coastal hazards for each community, the projected costs, and there is more information within those documents around some of the adaptation planning decisions that could be made over time. So to date, scenario planning and the costs associated with adaptation responses have been generally limited to costs of doing nothing or coastal protection responses. Under the planning policy, both accommodate and retreat are preferred options, with retreat being at the top of the hierarchy of decision making, and we haven't seen any final chair maps actually costing this work up, and we see it as a gap, and it's something that some of our councils are busy working with the state to try and resolve, but at this stage we haven't got those detailed figures on all of the options and all of the responses that we could undertake. Obviously these sorts of programs are quite costly and time consuming for local governments, and each individual council trying to undertake that work has been very time consuming, and there's a lot more work to be done. So it should be noted that the coastal monitoring is also important at this stage to get the better hazard data. And the PMP has developed a regional coastal monitoring action plan and a coastal monitoring manual and a database for gaining better data to further understand the current and future coastal hazards for better planning and response to coastal hazards. So as we've suggested, these chair maps have been developed and they'll need to be revisited over time when new data is up to date and made available. And we also are aware of the state having and decent data in that space as well. So a lot of work to be done, but also well underway.
Great, thank you. Councillor Jones, you mentioned earlier in your response around, I guess, one of the drivers, the reason why this partnership has come together, and the fact that climate change or the coast doesn't really have boundaries per se, so there's an imperative for local governments to come together and work together. I was wondering if you could identify any of the sort of the factors that have made this particular partnership so successful.
Sure. Well, I think the fact that we've got 9 willing councils and some leadership within those councils, both at staff level and councillor level, sorry, Joanne Ludbrook responding, is a huge factor in the beginning. So to actually have some leadership within the region and connections to some other partnerships nationally, like the Australian Coastal Councils Association and other, is a really good start in helping us understand that there is risk to our communities. A collaborative approach is something that is favoured under integrated coastal zone management. So when we look at coastal management decision making, it is all around regional effort. And obviously efficiency of effort at a regional scale. We talked about funding by all 9 councils being important to make sure that we're not all making the same mistakes across 9 councils, or shifting the problem elsewhere along our coastline is a huge acknowledgement by all 9 members. And it is a real credit to some of those leaders in the early stages of the partnership in having a vision of a shared coastline and the shared responsibility to respond to the risks along that shared coastline. There are some other, scientific reasons around sediment cells that the state government has some detailed information on. So realising that sand is moving along the coast, and the erosion models for our coast Australia-wide were first set up in Western Australia. And some of that work shows that we can actually break the coast up, not on boundaries of local governments, but on boundaries of how sand might stop and start as it travels along the coast. So there's a lot of coastal reasons and for all working together along that shared coastline.
And I can just add, yes, to Mark Jones, just in regard to the resources as well. So with the funding, we're able to employ 2 part-time officers, 1 full-time equivalent, to actually do that work and share it amongst all those local authorities as well. So there is a consistent approach rather than each local authority employing their own staff. You know, you would get different probably science and yeah, I think this is better. We can all learn and work together in that region and then still do a lot more detailed work in our own shires, but doing that regional approach and having that staff that cover all 9 local authorities definitely helps.
Well, thank you. Certainly an exemplar of coordination,
yeah.
A coordinated approach to a very complex issue. Ms. Ludbrook, you mentioned before around some of the quantitative costs and the modelling that's been done. Do you also have any data around the value of how the community sees the coastal region and in particular how that might relate to their physical and mental health?
Absolutely, yes. Joanne Ludbrook responding, there are some important general learnings that we do need to consider in undertaking coastal hazard assessments, risk assessments and scenario planning. So before I go into the specifics of the data, I will make some general comments based off what we have seen in other parts of Australia. There isn't a huge amount of data around the impacts on coastal hazards to mental health, but we have seen a lot of research done on vulnerable populations and on other impacts on the public space and what that means for people in their communities, some of which we've done ourselves and some of which we've drawn from Coast Adapt and other research studies that we've partnered in the past. So I'll start with just some general comments and then go into some more specifics around some quantitative data on that.
Thank you.
So what we know is that there is existing critical health and emergency services that may be affected in extreme weather events or under future sea level rise scenarios. When we're planning for critical services, i.e. emergency services, affordable housing and hospitals, coastal hazards and climate change factors should be considered. It's important to work with community to build resilience into these increasing risk areas and involve the communities in the decision-making process. Decisions need to be made with consideration to the potential likely risks associated with coastal hazards. Vulnerable communities, it is seen, may be the first affected and potentially the most affected, particularly in larger coastal storm events and larger cyclones. Climate change impacts have no boundaries, ignoring local and state government boundaries, obviously, and local government boundaries. So community resilience must be built. And regional scale partnerships like us are perfectly placed to address risk and optimise these opportunities and benefit all involved working with those individual councils. And it must be noted that the Perry Naturals Partnership doesn't define how each individual council takes this information and works with it, but we do work very closely with our councils in interpreting the science and developing up their individual coastal hazard assessments and other work that they ask us to support them in. So communities do place an extremely high value on the coast itself, and it provides physical, mental and spiritual benefits, and we do have data on this. People have cultural connections to the coast, particularly cultural heritage, and it must be noted that First Nations people, although may not be present in some parts of the coastal zone, have a huge part to play and have a lot of cultural heritage connections to those areas. In order to gain better understanding of what communities currently value on the coast and the values that were impacted, we have done a couple of studies. And in 2013 to 2015, the Perry Naturalist Partnership undertook a pilot scenario planning workshop in Busselton to involve coastal communities and capture key social, environmental and economic values with the help of Department of Planning funding. Again, we did ensure that we had that traditional owner representation and interview through that process, and that all that information is available on our website. Further, we have also developed and implemented a community research project with Production Function, Dr. Laura Stocker and Curtin University in 2016 to 2018. And this is where I have some more clear recent figures for you. The research has identified that the coastal communities place high importance on visiting beaches and foreshores in terms of providing physical fitness and mental and emotional health benefits. Coastal erosion and inundation mapping indicates that there will be significant loss to coastal foreshores and reserves from now until 2100. Consequently, there will be substantial impacts on the physical and mental emotional health and the well-being of much of our community. Our partnership and our projects and other researchers are findings suggest that coastal communities will be increasingly affected by coastal hazards. Local governments and their local communities are at the forefront of facing increasing risks from climate change factors, and there are many ways that these increasing risks have an impact on health services and human health in general. So to continue into the specifics, the results of the research project that included community surveys, participatory mapping workshops, identified a few challenges in relation to health. So in regards to the importance and benefits of living close to the beach, features such as the natural beach and the environment and the physical and mental spiritual benefits that provides was the greatest importance to our community in all three sites surveyed. So that was Dunsborough, Bunbury and Rockingham. And they placed greater importance than the built assets themselves. So the consequence of climate change, i.e. sea level rise, will result in a loss of valuable assets, and the qualities of such a loss of access changes, causes change to water safety and water quality, loss of access, pathways and meeting places, and this will have a negative impact on the community engaging in active and passive recreational activities and socialising in those areas. So the most popular use of the coastal areas were walking, running, swimming and spending time with families and friends. And in terms of the importance of visiting coastal areas and the benefits to human health and lifestyles was around well-being and mental and emotional health benefits. So these were ranked the highest importance. Around 60% of participants responded and said that these health and well-being benefits and to their mental and emotional health were the most important reason for living and visiting the coast. The physical benefits was second at around 50% of people that sort of put physical benefits as their secondary to their spiritual and emotional benefits. And then spiritual cultural was around 30%. So we're looking at the mental and emotional well-being being number one for the majority of our participants.
Very interesting. you mentioned then as well around vulnerable communities being the first affected and often will be most affected by change. I just wonder for your particular catchment area, which vulnerable groups in particular you've been able to identify?
I might defer to Mark for the Rockingham answer to this question, but in regards to more broadly, all of our four major town centres are located within the current flood zone. So that was a real precedent for the partnership to be put forward. So we're realising we're already living within all of our major infrastructure being within a vulnerable area, and that this is going to increase over time. They're also located on the coast, and as Councillor Jones alluded to earlier, we also have a sandy low-lying coastline. So we're looking at the challenges around inland flooding and increasingly storm surge and sea level rise now causing more risk to our communities. So these are our senior citizen centres, some of our hospitals. We talked about critical infrastructure around rescue centres, life-saving clubs being a really obvious one, being placed within the hazard zone itself. When it comes to private residents, we know that elderly people and a lot of more smaller developments or developments have potentially low socioeconomic people living in these vulnerable areas that may be inundated in the future.
Yes, and Mark Jones, I can only just add from Rockingham's experience, like I think I showed you that inundation plan where it actually you know, it's not just those on the coast that sort of looking at storm surges and water affecting a large inland area where there would be perhaps lower socioeconomic areas, not just those living right on the coast, it's those, you know, several hundred metres from the coast where water will get trapped in there and create health issues and damage and to property and health as well.
Thank you. I've got a bit of time, but I just wanted to ask an additional question which touches on something that you mentioned earlier, I think, in your opening statement, Councillor Jones, around tourism and industry. And I wondered how, if you wanted to make any comment on how climate change may affect tourism industry in the Perrin area and the impact that it might have on the community.
Okay. Well, again, Mark Jones, I can reflect on more City of Rockingham and the whole Perrin Naturalist Partnership. But I guess, you know, the ecotourism is a big component and an emerging industry in Rockingham for employment and tourism. So I guess we've got, you know, the white sandy beaches, which could potentially be lost, but also, you know, those snorkelling areas and the islands and access to boat ramps. I think I mentioned that before as well. So there's a lot of boat users. And that's increasing as well. So it's just how they access the water. It's just the whole going back again. Thanks to that coastal amenity that will be lost. You know, if we lose a lot of the existing beaches without a planned retreat, I think that's the big one. Is it would be nice to plan a retreat back that there's more public reserves which are established rather than just being private houses and rock walls and you lose the beaches. So I think that's a good mechanism, but it's how's that funded and planned. That's the big unknown and the gap at the moment, I believe.
Yeah, so Joanne Ladbrook, I think that across the Perrin Naturalist region we see it as a huge tourism area.
Mandurah Busselton,
and we also have some internationally recognised environmental hotspots within the region. Ramsar listed wetlands, and we're seeing some migratory bird sites lost. So for those ecotourism operators, that there's some major risks to their potential incomes and the economic benefits that those areas rely upon. But also within the section between Mandurah and Bunbury itself is some of the spots where people like to four-wheel drive along the beaches. And you know, obviously this amenity is potentially what is being shown to be at risk. So not only is it the tourism operators, the hotels that are situated along the foreshore themselves and the huge economic risk associated with tourism, but obviously those are some of the more passive activities or remote activities are also at risk in areas that aren't as built up as well. So you'll find in the major town centres, I'm sure some of the economic challenges around tourism are there into the future, but also outside of the major town centres themselves, there's some huge risk to the amenity that it provides to tourism and the social amenity.
Thank you. Would you like to make any further final comments before we close today's hearing?
No, not from me. Thank you.
No, thank you.
Councillor Jones and Ms Ludbrook, thank you for your attendance at today's hearing. A transcript of this hearing will be sent to you so that you can correct minor factual errors before it is placed on the public record. Please return the transcript within 10 working days of the date of the covering letter or email, otherwise it will be deemed to be correct. While you cannot amend your evidence, if you would like to explain particular points in more detail or present further information, in particular we'd love to see those maps,
okay.
You can provide this as an addition to your submission to the inquiry when you return the transcript. Once again, thank you both very much for your evidence today. Thank you.
Thank you
very much.